Having introduced the Einstein equation, we can now solve it. And so today we'll solve it for cosmology in the most important, most symmetric case. So we will study the so-called Friedmann-Lemaître cosmological solutions. Here's the experimental evidence that supports the idea that these solutions are pretty accurate. The experimental evidence is that the universe is expanding and has been expanding in the past. That's a finding that goes back to 1929. Also, the universe, quite amazingly, appears to be essentially isotropic and homogeneous, and that's something we need to explain. Because a manifold could have any shape, and the manifold of space-time appears to be spatially isotropic, so the directions are all the same, and also homogeneous, which means it's everywhere the same, on average. So if you average over length scales of 3-4 billion light years, then the universe is pretty much uniform. Now, the Friedmann-Lemaître models are idealizing this and saying, okay, pretty much uniform means it's a good approximation to say it's exactly uniform. And implementing that exact isotropy and exact homogeneity means that the number of degrees of freedom is dramatically reduced, and we can actually solve the Einstein equation for solutions that have that isotropy and homogeneity. So the pioneers in this were Lemaître and Friedmann, and later Robertson and Walker. Concretely, this is how we solve the Einstein equation under the assumption that the universe is the same in all directions and wherever you go. So technically, we are assuming that we can model space-time as a manifold, M, with a metric, G, such that the manifold is given by a spatial manifold, a Riemannian manifold, cross a time interval. Now, that time interval could be infinite, or it could be finite. The universe could have a finite lifetime. It might have come from a Big Bang, and then eventually end in a big crunch, in which case it would be finite timeline. But it could also have a beginning, or it could have an end, but not the one, not the other. So regarding time, there's an interval. Regarding space, we assume that it's some spatial Riemannian manifold, which could be R3, or it could be more complicated. We will cover that in a moment. So the metric then, we assume has the following form. We can write it as a dt squared and an a squared on the diagonal. So there's going to be a spatial metric that we will call G bar, so the Riemannian manifold that describes just space at one point in time, we will describe by a metric tensor G bar, and the full metric tensor of space-time, we will just write as G. Okay, so keep that in mind. If it's just G, it's the metric for space-time. The G bar is the metric for just space. And since space is going to grow, or we can also describe a shrinking space-time, that metric is multiplied with a scale factor, a squared of t. So I is an interval, a time interval, which may or may not be infinite. The time variable that we will use here is also called the cosmic time. And a of t is called the scale factor. The spatial manifold is going to be a Riemannian manifold. The full manifold is going to be a Lorentzian manifold. So the metric for the full space-time can always locally be put in the form minus 1, 1, 1, 1. For example, by choosing a Riemann normal coordinate system. And the spatial metric, G bar, can always locally be put in the form 1, 1, 1. These are the assumptions that go into the Friedmann Lemaître way of trying to solve the Einstein equation. Okay, so the spatial part, which might be R3, for example, of the space-time, is assumed to be fully isotropic and homogeneous. So, as I said, it doesn't matter in which direction we look, doesn't matter where we are, translation and rotation invariance is what you want. So sigma, the spatial manifold with its metric, g bar, we assume to be a fully isotropic and homogeneous Riemannian manifold. And fully isotropic and homogeneous means it's a manifold of constant curvature. The curvature should not change as we rotate. It should not change as we translate. So at each point in time, at each point in cosmic time, we want to have a Riemannian manifold of constant curvature, which we will describe by sigma and g bar. What? Okay. So what could these Riemannian manifolds be that we have at each point in time? So remember, space-time we can think of as a stack of stacked pancakes. At every point in time, we have one of those pancakes, which is a spatial slice. And then at each point, we have one of those. And you know, together, they make up the four-dimensional space-time. But at every point in time, we just have one of those pancakes in space, which is three-dimensional and described as a manifold capital sigma with a metric g bar. Each of these pancakes has to have full translation and rotation invariance, constant curvature. What could this possibly be concretely? Well, if we want to classify the Riemann manifolds of constant curvature, let us start with the Riemann tensor. So we take one of these pancakes, sigma g. It will have its Riemann curvature tensor. Because this is only spatial, we are using Latin indices instead of Greek ones. So these only run from 1 to 3. And the bar indicates this is just spatial indices. So this is the Riemann curvature tensor for just a spatial slice. And it must be expressible in terms of a constant, right? We are saying it's got to be scalar curvature, just constant curvature everywhere. And the tensorial part, the index structure, has to be given canonically in order to have translation and rotation invariance. So it has to depend on the canonical metric g bar. We know what the index structure is of the Riemann curvature tensor. Namely, we have antisymmetry in the first two indices, antisymmetry in the second two indices, and we have symmetry if we interchange the first two with the last two. And then you can convince yourself that the only way you can build such an index structure using the metric tensor, and we don't have any other tensors available, is this particular combination of the metric tensors. And then some scalar prefactor. And that scalar prefactor will determine how strong the curvature is. So any Riemann curvature tensor of constant curvature takes this form. It's a number times this combination of the metric. Then if we contract two of those indices, we obtain the Ricci tensor. The Ricci tensor for the spatial slicing. So it has a bar too. Two indices now. After we contract the corresponding indices over there, we get that the Ricci tensor that follows from this Riemann curvature tensor is 2k g bar. And then if we contract that as well with the metric, and remember we have to take, of course, the metric g bar to do all of these contractions, then we obtain here 6k. Why 6? Well, because the metric is 3 by 3, times 1, 1, 1, and we do this contraction here. All the components are the same, so we get a factor of 3. (Clears throat) Now let's use a triad. What's a triad? It's like a tetrad, but tetrad is for four basis vectors. You use that when you have four-dimensional space-time. Now we're just looking at the three-dimensional spatial slices. And then it's only three basis vectors. And I don't know Greek, but I think this means three in ancient Greek. So it's a triad. And the basis vectors that we are going to choose, such that the metric takes the form 1, 1, 1, is, and therefore builds a frame, is the theta, we call them theta bar I. So these are going to be our basis vectors in the space of cotangent vectors to the spatial manifold sigma and g bar. Then we can write, now that we have the Riemann curvature tensor and we have a choice of bases in the cotangent spaces, we can define the curvature 2 form. Remember how that works? Curvature 2 form is obtained from the Riemann curvature tensor by declaring two of its lower indices that are antisymmetric as being representing a 2 form. So we take these indices, contract with these bases here, and then we are only left with two other indices. Now we see that the Riemann curvature tensor can be viewed as a 2 form with respect to these two indices and those basis vectors. And then that gives us a 2 tensor valued 2 form. Right? So that's what the Riemann curvature tensor is. We know what the Riemann curvature tensor actually is for a space of constant curvature. It's given by all of this business with the metric and the K. And if we plug that in here explicitly, we can do lots of contractions and we end up finding that the Riemann curvature tensor, the Riemann curvature 2 form is simply K times theta times theta. Remember what the role of K is? K tells us how much curvature we have. If k is 0, the curvature tensor is 0. K is 0 means flat space. But for a space to have the same curvature everywhere, the curvature doesn't have to vanish. Right? It could be constant curvature. That's what the k describes. So let's look at what the role of the k is. The role of K can be distinguished in that, regarding the role of K, we have to distinguish three cases, positive K, K equals 0, K smaller than 0. By the way, what we're doing here is a classification of all those Riemannian manifolds that have full isotropy and homogeneity, that are constant curvature in three dimensions. We could also do this in 3+1 dimensions. A different story, because now we have Lorentzian signature and we have one dimension more, it's four dimensional. Does anybody know how you call these constant curvature 3+1 dimensional manifolds? They're de Sitter and anti de Sitter spaces. But here we're just doing this in three dimensions for now. Okay, so for k larger 0, what do we have? In this case, when k is larger 0, we have curvature, positive curvature, and the sigma, our spatial slice, our pancake, is a three-dimensional sphere, constant curvature, a sphere, but a three-dimensional one. Don't think of it as a two-dimensional sphere embedded in three. No, it's a three-dimensional sphere, which you may embed, for example, in a four-dimensional space, but you don't have to embed it. So for positive k, our spatial pancakes are three-dimensional spheres. What it would mean is that if you travel in any direction and you just keep going, then after a while, you'll come back to where you started. Just like on a sphere, like on the Earth, you travel in any direction you want. If you keep going straight, you come back to where you started. And that would be the same for our universe. You can go straight in any direction you want. You'll come back to where you started, if k is positive. In this case, the universe is a closed universe. It has a finite volume, just like a sphere in 2D has a finite area. Oh, sorry about that.
Yeah, suspected spam caller. Can you imagine?
Okay, for k equal to 0, we know what it is. It's no curvature, right? The Riemann curvature tensor vanishes, so clearly no curvature. So what we have is that our pancakes, our spatial pancakes, are Euclidean R3. Flat, infinite size universe, infinite volume. What if k, the curvature, is negative? Well, in that case, our spatial pancakes are three-dimensional, so-called pseudospheres. Now, the constant negative curvature is very difficult to visualize, but maybe the closest is to think of it as being a saddle everywhere. Right? Like a saddle is typical for a negative curvature. And these negative curvature spatial slices also possess an infinite volume. So only the positive curvature spaces close into themselves and have a finite volume. These two have infinite volume. Now, the Riemann curvature tensor contains two spatial derivatives and time derivatives, which means that the units of the curvature tensor are 1 over length squared. Curvature tensor is not unitless. It has units of 1 over length squared. That means that k has units 1 over length squared, because the metric doesn't have units, right? And that means that we can choose our units of length to be such that k takes any value we want, except we can't change the sign of it. Right? So if you work with any kind of units, like meters or inches or miles, then the sign of k will always be the same. But the value of k you can choose by choosing your units of length. And you still have a unit of length free. Once you've chosen to measure velocities as multiples of c and to measure actions as multiples of h bar, you still have the freedom to choose a length scale. There are three units, three fundamental units, like kilograms, meters, seconds. You can also use speed of light, h bar, and whatever length you want. So whatever the value of k is in nature, when you've chosen some length scale, you can always choose to measure length in such a way that k comes out to be numerically minus 1, 0, or plus 1, which is a convention that cosmologists like to use. It's not like that nature is discrete and only does k equal minus 1 or k equal plus 1 or 0. It's a uniform quantity, and so what really matters is only the sign of it. And the value of it is a matter of choice of units, and therefore we might as well choose it to be such minus 1, 0, or 1. Just keep in mind that once you've made that choice, you can't make that choice again, right? You fix now your length scale. Okay, so we define a triad. Now let's define a tetrad for space-time. Because remember, we have the space-time manifold with its metric g, so it's a manifold m with metric g. And we have the spatial slices sigma with metric g bar and curvature tensor r bar and so on. Okay, so the metric for space-time looks like this. That's how we started out, where this is the g bar, the metric of the spatial slices. And you see it doesn't immediately enter g, but it's multiplied with a squared because we need that to allow the space-time to be described as shrinking or growing. So now we define a tetrad, which is to say an orthonormal basis of our cotangent space, and with a dual basis also the tangent space, such that the metric is actually everywhere eta. And how can we do that? Easy. We choose for the basis vector, for the first basis vector in the cotangent space, this basis vector, dt. In this way, the metric will have the minus dt squared goes into minus theta naught squared. And then we choose as our basis vectors in the cotangent space in the spatial directions theta I, the a times theta bar I. Since the theta bar are already a triad for the spatial degrees of freedom, this a I mean, we have two of the theta bars arising in here. So this a squared will be absorbed in here. And so you see that if we choose this basis, then the metric will simply take the form of eta of minus 1, 1, 1, 1. Remember again, the theta bar form a triad, so a frame for the spatial slice, for the sigma. Capital sigma was the name of the spatial slice with its metric g bar. And the theta without the bar form a frame or a tetrad with respect to the metric of the full space-time. Now that we have that, and remember, this is something we discussed earlier in the abstract. We said, yes, we get to choose our basis vectors in the tangent and cotangent spaces freely. They don't have to be associated with the change of with the coordinates. But how can we actually specify what basis vectors we like? Well, we take the basis vectors that come with the coordinate system, which would be these, and the dxi, which are basically these for the spatial slices, and then relate the ones that we really want to the ones that come with the coordinate system, and that's what we did here. Right. Now that we have that, we need to know how can we express the torsion in terms of the variables that we use, and how can we express the curvature in terms of the variables that we use, these variables. Now, the torsion is zero, but it's still interesting to express it, because we get an equation, such and such is equal to zero. Now, do you remember what the name was of these equations that describe the torsion and the curvature in terms of structure equations, right? So, the first structure equation, let us look at the first structure equation for the spatial slices for each individual pancake. There we have the first structure equation is that d of theta bar plus, and then we have here the connection one form, which the theta bar equal to zero. If there were torsion, we would have the torsion two form over there, but it's vanishing. Okay, so that's the first structure equation for the spatial pancake. And there is also a first structure equation, of course, for the big manifold, for the space-time manifold, takes the same form, but without the bars. Because now, this is the connection one form for the 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time, and these are the basis vectors, these guys, without the bar of the full space-time manifold. Let's call this equation here sigma 1, and this one m1 for structure equation 1, structure equation 1 for the spatial slice for the full space-time. And here the indices are Latin indices running only from 1 to 3. And here the indices are Greek indices running from 0 to 3. Because that's the entire space-time here. Later, of course, we will also look into the second structure equations, the one for the spatial slice and the one for the full space-time. So now we can derive the connection, the four connection one form, omega mu nu. See, we want to build up to the Einstein equations. We want to calculate what the connection one form is, and then eventually the curvature. And once we have the curvature two form, we can read off again what the Riemann curvature tensor is and plug it into the Einstein equation. We could do the Einstein equation in the formulation of tensor-valued forms, or we could do the Einstein equation in the traditional way. Here we will just use the tensor-valued forms framework as a shortcut to the traditional Einstein equation. A traditional means, of course, you know, in terms of the metric and not in the terms of the tensor-valued forms. Okay, so how does this work? How do we calculate the connection one form for the four-dimensional space-time in the spatially isotropic and homogeneous case? The strategy is that we calculate d theta I in two ways, namely using the first structure equation for the spatial slice, one case, or this first structure equation for the full space-time. So let's see. We have d theta I is equal to d of a theta bar I. Because remember, theta I was a theta bar I. We needed that definition that theta is a theta bar I, such that the metric in terms of the 3+1 dimensional frame was simply -1, 1, 1, 1. We had to absorb the scale factor a, and that's why there is this a in the definition of the theta. Okay, so the d theta is d of that, because this is by definition that. And then we use the Leibniz rule, and we have the d applied to the a, carrying this forward, and the other term is carrying the a forward and then applying the d to that one form here. And what is that then? Well, the dA is dA by dt dt. dt is, of course, theta 0. So it's dA by dt dt, carrying that forward. And then here we have carrying the a forward. And here we use the first structure equation for the spatial pancakes, which tells us that the d theta bar is given by connection 1 form times theta bar. It's just using the structure equation that we had above, using the fact that there's no torsion. Okay, now dA by dt is a dot. So a dot is going to be the notation for the quick notation for the time derivative of the scale factor. It will come up all the time. So dA by dt is a dot. Then dt is, by our definition above, theta naught. We only needed the scale factor for the spatial part, but for the temporal part, for dt, we don't need any scale factor. Our frame basis vector was the same as the dt. Okay, so we just carry this forward here. And then from here to here, we go by combining this a with that theta bar just to get the theta, right? Because theta was a times theta bar. Also here, we have a theta bar. If only that was multiplied with an a, then we could drop the bar, right? But it's not multiplied with an a, so what do? We multiply with an a and divide by an a. Then we get a 1 over a over here, and we get a theta bar times a, which is the theta without a bar. I also switched around the sequence of this one, the spatial here, the temporal there, and here's the other way around. This way we introduce a minus sign because the wedge product between one forms is anti-symmetric. And this is just carried forward. Okay, so we have that d theta can be written in this way. Now let's use the first structure equation directly on the 3+1 dimensional manifold. And we calculate again what d theta I is. By the first structure equation, it's this. And let's spell that out, what that is. This is having Greek indices, so it runs from 0 to 3. Let's write this as the term with the 0, 0, and the term with just the spatial indices. And that's good, because then we can compare the temporal part here, the temporal part there, and the temporal part and the spatial part here to the spatial part over there. And what we can read off is now that the connection 1 form, just by comparing here and there, we can read off that the spatial parts are exactly the same. So the connection 1 form in 3+1 dimensions is the connection 1 form in 3 dimensions for the space-space components. But for the space-time components, we have that there is this a dot, minus a dot over a. But this minus sign here and there, I mean here and there. And so we identified that. So now we have the connection 1 form in 3+1 dimensions, expressed explicitly in terms of the quantities that carry the information, which is this one. Remember, we are no longer working with a metric to carry the information, because the metric in a frame is just -1, 1, 1, 1. Right? So the information is all in the thetas and how the theta relate to the dxi. All right, so now we have the connection 1 form in terms of the frame. Once we have the connection 1 form, we can calculate the curvature 2 form. How? Well, that's what the second structure equation is good for. Remember, the first structure equation gives you the torsion, which is 0. And the second structure equation gives you the Riemann curvature tensor. And again, we have two second structure equations. One for the manifold, space-time manifold and one for just the spatial slice. So we get one second structure equation for the unbarred quantity and one for the barred quantities. So what we can then do is we write down the unbarred quantity, the unbarred equation, but for the spatial parts only to start with. So if we here just take the spatial parts, then this becomes that. Here we get this, but we still have to sum these guys from 0 to 3. It's just the I and the J that run only from 1 to 3 now. And then we had an equation in the box before. Here it is. We had that the omega is omega bar for the spatial indices, and the omega is a dot over a for the space-time indices. Where are we now? Right, so we just carried these things forward here, and then here we are using that for the space-space indices. Whether or not there is a bar makes no difference, as we just saw in the equation in the box. And here we have that for the space-space parts, again, we get no change, we can just put the bar on it. But for the time part, which is arising as the fourth term, here we're summing over four terms, right? The fourth term, the one with the time, space-time components, is this one. And so we recognize that this part is just the curvature 2 form on the space-time manifold, on the slices, and this is the extra term from the space-time. And we also remember that how we started this lecture today was to say that we have isotropy and homogeneity, therefore constant curvature, and therefore the curvature 2 form on the spatial slice has to be just a number times that, right? We calculated that. We know how the barred basis vectors relate to the unbarred basis vectors, namely up to a factor of a. So this can be written like that, k over a squared, right? Because theta bar times a is theta. Okay, so we have the curvature 2 form expressed in the space-time, space-space components, in terms of the curvature 2 form on the pancake, on the spatial slice, plus this extra term. This part, we just identified what it is. So we can say that the curvature 2 form, space-space components, is, and we plug all of this in here, it's this expression here, plus this part, which arises from the relationship between the zero I components and the theta that we saw in the equation in the box before. All right, so what we now have is the space-space components of the curvature 2 form in space-time. It's this expression here. See, this term and that term combine because these are the same basis vectors. And then I leave it to you as an exercise to work out what the space-time components are, very similarly, by using the structure equations for the for the space-time manifold and for the spatial slice. So we also get the Riemann curvature 2 form, also it's a zero I component. It's space-time components. Right, okay, so let's keep these equations in mind. So now we can calculate the Einstein tensor. First of all, what was the Riemann, what was the curvature 2 form? See, now that we quickly calculated what the curvature 2 form is, let us translate the result that we have back into the traditional formulation in terms of the Riemann curvature tensor. So remember what the relationship was. The curvature 2 form is 1 half Riemann curvature tensor and then these two basis vectors. Remember where this came from? It came from saying that two of the indices of the Riemann curvature tensor are to be viewed as belonging to a two form. So now we can read off what the Riemann curvature tensor is, because we know what the omega is, and we know these guys, so we can read off what the Riemann curvature tensor is. And from that, we can read off what the Ricci tensor is and what the curvature scalar R is. It's a little tedious, but not too much. I leave it to you to do that calculation. And then we obtain the Einstein tensor. So please do that calculation. It's less than a page. Should be straightforward, but everybody should have done this once in their life. Super important cosmological solution. Okay, so the Einstein tensor is, of course, what is on the left-hand side of the Einstein equation. And plugging this stuff in here, we obtain that the Einstein tensor has the following form. First of all, it's diagonal. Super important, the Einstein tensor on a homogeneous isotropic space-time is diagonal. G mu nu is zero if mu is not equal nu. The zero zero component of the Einstein tensor comes out like this. And the space space components are all the same, and they are that. So remember what we have in here. We have the Einstein tensor expressed in terms of two quantities. The scale factor, which is a function of time that will describe the size of the universe, and k, which could be minus 1, 0, or plus 1. Plus 1 means closed universe. 0 means the universe is R3 spatially. And k negative means that it's hyperbolic. It is like a saddle point everywhere. It has negative curvature. And is of infinite volume. Okay, so the left-hand side of the Einstein equation looks like this. The Einstein tensor is diagonal, and this is what is on the diagonal. We can already anticipate what the Einstein equations are going to look like then. Basically, we are going to get two Einstein equations, one for the zero-zero component and one for the II component. For each of the II components, the same thing, because as you can see, I doesn't feature in here. Okay, so G mu nu is diagonal. Now, let's look at the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. What we can deduce here, logically, is that the energy-momentum tensor must be diagonal. There are multiple ways you can find out what the energy-momentum tensor is. And this is a peculiar way to find out what the energy-momentum tensor is. Namely, we did it this way. We observed that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. From that assumption, we found that the Einstein tensor has to have the particular form that we got. Diagonal, it has a funny zero-zero component, a funny II set of II components, but it's diagonal. And if the Einstein equation is to hold, it means that, therefore, isotropy and homogeneity imply that the energy-momentum tensor must be diagonal. So whatever matter there is in the universe, whatever causes the universe to be homogeneous and isotropic, must have an energy-momentum tensor that's diagonal where the Einstein tensor is diagonal. Because the Einstein tensor is diagonal. In these coordinates, the Einstein tensor is diagonal, so the energy-momentum tensor has to be diagonal as well. That's a super important information to have. Because it means that the energy-momentum tensor has also only 2 degrees of freedom. It has a non-trivial zero-zero component. It has a non-trivial 1-1 component. And already the 2-2 and 3-3 components are just duplicates of the 1-1 component. And it's going to be diagonal, so the zeros everywhere else. So that means that in our study of cosmology, we can focus on just what the zero-zero and the II components of the energy-momentum tensor are doing. And this is before we even think about the standard model of particle physics or whatever matter is around. Simply the observation of homogeneity and isotropy forces, under the assumption that the Einstein equation is right, forces that the energy momentum tensor has to have that simple structure. Okay, now let's look at the interpretation of the entries of the energy momentum tensor. Now that we know that it has to be of this form, right? So the energy momentum tensor has to be of the form of something non-trivial on the zero-zero component and something, but the same things, on the II components and zero-zero elsewhere. Now we know from our studies before of Killing vector fields and so on that what's sitting here is energy density and what's sitting there is pressure. If what we're dealing with is a gas, then pressure makes sense. Of course, if what we're dealing with, if the dominant contribution to energy momentum is not from some gas, but instead is from some quantum field, then we can't really talk of the pressure of the quantum field, because this is not thermodynamics, this is not statistical physics. This quantum field might be in a pure state and still contribute to the II components. But as far as cosmology is concerned, as far as the cosmology community is concerned, the terminology has been adopted to simply call whatever is there pressure. Right? So keep in mind, it need not be thought of as particles colliding with each other and the speed and oomph with which they do it is the pressure. This could just be a field in a pure state. As long as it contributes to the II components, we'll call it pressure. Okay, so, well, and then there's the cosmological constant, as we saw. Now, the cosmological constant, if you remember, logically originates on the left-hand side of the Einstein equation. It comes with the curvature. Remember, according to Sakharov's analysis, quantum field theory produces the Einstein action. It also produces the cosmological constant term to lowest order, way too large, but anyway, it produces it. Right, the effective action, the quantum effective action, the quantum fluctuations of matter fields produce cosmological constant term in the action, produce the Einstein action with the exact correct prefactors if an ultraviolet cutoff at the Planck length is imposed, and it produces higher order terms that are enormously suppressed that we therefore neglect, but which may be important near singularities, right? Because near singularities, the curvature can go. It doesn't have to, as we will see, but it can go infinite. And if it does, that may make even heavily suppressed curvature terms in the action contribute. Anyway, so in principle, we have the cosmological constant term, and it arises with all the other curvature terms on the left-hand side of the Einstein equation. But it is traditional to move the cosmological constant term onto the other side and throw it in with the energy momentum tensor on the right-hand side, which is why there is a minus sign here, because this comes from the other side of the Einstein equation. And we put it over here. The cosmological constant is on the right there. Which, as we will see later, means the following. Since we move it from the left-hand side to the right-hand side, the cosmological constant can be viewed as being part of the energy momentum tensor. And how does it contribute to the energy momentum tensor? There's a minus sign. There's a minus sign. Remember, the cosmological constant multiplies the metric, right? And so we have a minus sign here, and there's a minus sign. It gives us a plus, which means we get the positive energy contribution. So the cosmological constant contributes positively to the energy density, but it contributes negatively to the pressure. Okay, so what we have found here, to summarize, is this. We started with the empirical observation that space-time is, to a very good approximation, at least if you average over several billions of light years, to a very good approximation, it is homogeneous and isotropic. I know, it's a pretty crude averaging, right? So if you average on those scales, it's pretty well homogeneous and isotropic. This forced the energy moment, the Einstein tensor to take a particular form, and that forced the energy momentum tensor to have a particular form, namely this one. And therefore, empirically, we know that whatever matter is around, dark matter, visible matter, whatever it might be, what it does eventually boils down to contributing to this and contributing to that. So the only non-trivial degrees of freedom in the matter that play a role in gravity is rho and p and their relationship. Now, you may know from thermodynamics that the so-called equation of state describes the relationship between energy density of a gas and the pressure, right? So you put pressure on a gas, you raise the energy density, and vice versa. But it depends on what kind of gas it is, and whether it's a fluid, perhaps. So there is the equation of state that describes the relationship between energy density and pressure. And that is still something that we cannot deduce from just saying that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. From that alone, we cannot tell what the relationship between rho and p might be. This is the only thing that the theory of matter still has to provide, what the relationship is between energy density and pressure. But we will need that, of course. Okay, so what kind of matter produces such an energy momentum tensor? You see, there could be all kinds of matter out there in the universe, but the dominant part has to be that a kind of matter that produces this kind of energy momentum tensor, diagonal and so on. So the proposition is that the Tmu nu of any Friedmann-Lemaître spacetime is always of the form of that of a perfect fluid. Remember how that looks like? It's the one with the rho and PPP, right? The matter doesn't have to be a fluid itself. It could also be just a suitable quantum field, which is in a state such that the energy momentum tensor that it produces takes that form. In any case, it has to, from the symmetry of the space-time, we deduce that there can only be these 2 degrees of freedom, rho and p, in the matter. At least, these are the only degrees of freedom that play a role as far as gravity is concerned. So to see this, consider the 4-vector field dual to dt. So theta naught is dt, and that's a cotangent vector. The tangent vector is that's dual to it is d by dt. And let's give this a name. It's u. We will also call it e naught, the first basis vector. Then we can define a 4-vector u by summing over u mu e mu, where u naught is 1 and u I are 0. So this is simply to say that this vector consists of just e naught, right? So u is e naught. To write this down in a covariant way is to say we sum over all 4 indices, but it has only one contribution in the 4, because the only the u 0 is 1 and the others are all 0. This is just a complicated but covariant way of writing this, that u naught is e naught. So now, using this vector u, this tangent vector u, which will play the role of the tangent to the motion of molecules in a gas, okay, or perfect fluid. This u vector we can now use to write down the Tmu nu that we derived from homogeneity and isotropy in the following way. Tmu nu can be written in this way. It's simply saying that the u mu, if you write out what it is, if you just spell out what that is, you get a matrix which is rho PPP, and then you also have minus the lambdas, cosmological constant. It's just a covariant way of writing this. And you may recognize or remember that this was the energy momentum tensor of a perfect fluid. And then what role does this u play in this? if we interpret the energy momentum tensor as arising in this way, as being actually a perfect fluid, then what is the U? Well, the U would be the velocity vector of a particle in that fluid. And why would that be so? Well, U is tangent to time-like geodesics. And here's the calculation of that. If we calculate the covariant derivative of U in the direction of U, then this is zero if and only if U is a geodesic. So we can work out what that is. U is just E naught. So it's the covariant derivative of E naught in the direction of E naught. Then we take the affine connection, plug in the direction in which we want to covariantly differentiate, get this value here. We have to contract it with E mu. We can then go back and see what we calculated the affine connection to be for the space-time components. And it was this thing with the A dot over A. And then we had here the theta I, which we have to evaluate at E naught. But you see, the thetas are the dual basis to the E. And therefore, the theta I, E naught, is Kronecker delta I naught, which is zero. So the whole thing vanishes, and so this is geodesic. So for example, it could be a gas of galaxies, where every galaxy is a grain in the gas. And the galaxies are just geodesically moving in the universe. Okay, so now let's put everything together and solve the Einstein equation. This is going to be important for the project, right? Because do this numerically for some weird cases. Do it for the standard stuff, but play around with it. You know, check out how the universe can bounce and jump and all of those things. Check out what happens if you make this or the other assumption. Okay, but let's do it systematically. Einstein equation. On the left-hand side, we have the Einstein tensor. On the right-hand side, we have 8 pi g, energy momentum tensor. Now, this looks like this. We have the 0,0 component, and we have the II component. There are two different equations. There's no equation from the off-diagonal, because these guys are diagonal. And then the II components are all the same. So there are just two equations. The 0,0 component of the Einstein equation gives us this equation, which has a special name. It's also called the Friedmann equation. And the II components give us that equation here. Let's have a look at what we got here. So these two equations constitute the Einstein equations in the case of homogeneity and isotropy, in the presence, potentially, of a cosmological constant. The 0,0 component of the Einstein equation is sensitive to the energy density, because the energy density occurs in the 0,0 component. So here we have the energy density on the right from the energy momentum tensor. And we see that the cosmological constant contributes the same way that the energy density does. Right? So, for example, if the universe was to lose some energy density and gain a cosmological constant, yeah, that could just make up for each other. Of course, the cosmological constant better be a constant, right? For the cosmological constant is by definition a constant. It's just a term in the action and in the equations that just is a number. So, sorry for having said that this thing could be dynamic. It's not dynamic. The point is that the cosmological constant, the value of the cosmological constant can offset the value of the energy density. They contribute in exactly the same way. The cosmological constant contributes positive energy density if it is itself positive. On the left-hand side, we have the scale factor. We have the time derivative of the scale factor. In fact, we have scale factor's time derivative over A squared, a quantity that will become important later on. And we have this K. Remember, if K is equal to zero, the spatial slices of space-time are flat. If K is positive, space-time is a huge sphere. If K is negative, then space-time is a space of constant negative curvature and has infinite volume. Okay, so that's the Friedmann equation. So given that this is a constant, what is it relating? Well, it's a differential equation for A, the scale factor. A differential equation for the scale factor that depends on K, which is a constant. G is a constant, just a gravitational constant, but rho is dynamical. And the energy density cannot be expected to be a constant. Of course, as the universe is expanding or shrinking, the energy density should diminish or grow, right? Because we have a dilution of matter and energy. So this differential equation relates two dynamical quantities, the scale factor and the energy density. Now let's look at the II component of the Einstein equation. That gives us this equation here. Now on the right-hand side is the pressure that comes from the energy momentum tensor. And we see now that the cosmological constant contributes negatively. So the positive cosmological constant contributes positively to the energy density, but contributes the opposite sign to the pressure. So it contributes a negative pressure, which is weird. Right? So it's like, yeah, we don't really have any other examples for that. And on the left-hand side, we again have the scale factor and its first and second derivative, and we have the K. That's a constant. So what is dynamical here in the second equation? Well, A is dynamical, and it's also being differentiated, so it's a differential equation in A. But P, of course, also is dynamical. It will depend on time. Because clearly, as the universe, let's say, grows and dilutes, the pressure we would expect to diminish somehow. And of course, we will now, in a moment, use the fact that we have some handle on how the pressure and the energy density should scale as the universe is growing, for example, or shrinking. And that we can use then to help solve these two equations. So what we have here is, in total, how many dynamical quantities? Three. That's right. Because we have the scale factor, we have the energy density and the pressure. And how many equations do we have? Two. Not done yet, right? You can't solve it yet. So we need one more. Well, first of all, we make a useful observation, which is that in principle, these equations are sensitive to whether the universe is open or closed. It's sensitive to what the value of K is, positive or negative or zero, right? Because it occurs here and it occurs there. But very nicely, the same expression occurs here and there. So if we just add the two equations, I mean, this one we have to divide by 3, and then we add the two equations, then this term just drops out. So we will be left with an equation that doesn't contain K anymore. Let's just do this. So we take the first equation divided by 3, add it to the second equation, then multiply it with a convenient factor, and we get this equation here. And then we can rearrange things a little bit, and we obtain that equation here. So we are not yet where we want to be, which is three equations for three unknowns. But it's okay, we can already draw some conclusions here. It's just working with the two equations, just working with the Einstein equations. We can draw some conclusions here. Let's look at what we have. We have here the acceleration of the scale factor of the universe. And A is the scale factor, A dot is how fast it expands, A double dot is the acceleration of the expansion or shrinkage. And what we see is that this acceleration of the universe is minus some number times the scale factor, which is always positive. And then we have the energy density and the pressure, which for matter are always positive. So we have positive, 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 negative. And if there's no cosmological constant, this is telling us that the universe has to decelerate. Right? So if the universe is expanding, if something kicked it off, if for some reason there was some explosion at the beginning, then that expansion has to slow down. Because there's going to be some positive energy densities, some positive pressure. A, the scale factor is going to be positive, and the whole thing is negative. So it has to decelerate. It doesn't mean that the universe has to recollapse, right? It could just get slower and slower and slower. It's a bit like you throw a stone upwards. Well, it will decelerate. And then chances are it's going to come crashing back. But if you throw your stone fast enough, it will go forever. It will also forever decelerate, because the Earth will always pull on it. No matter how far away it is, the Earth will always pull on it. It will always decelerate. But if you kick it off fast enough, namely faster than the escape velocity of something like 4.7 kilometers a second or so, then it will, yes, always decelerate, but never quite come to a standstill and fall back. And the same is true here for the universe. The universe might just go on forever, or it might recollapse. It depends on the actual details of it. There is sort of an escape velocity. There is a critical density beyond which, and we will get to this, it will recollapse or not recollapse. But it has to always decelerate. Gravity is attractive, and therefore, you know, stuff might want to move apart faster and faster, but intuitively, because gravity is attractive, you know, the universe wants to shrink. Of course, that picture of attractive gravity is about matter. This is about space-time itself. So don't take that too literally. Okay, so what we concluded here is that the universe wants to recollapse. It may not succeed, but it's definitely decelerating, assuming that there's no cosmological constant. But now imagine there is a cosmological constant. What is it going to do? You see, this is positive. That's a scale factor. If there's a positive cosmological constant, that's going to contribute positively to the acceleration. And that means that the cosmological constant is counteracting this. In principle, the universe wants to, if it's going and expanding, matter, no matter what it is, it wants to make it shrink again. At least it will succeed in decelerating it. Except the cosmological constant may get into the way. And now imagine a situation where the cosmological constant actually dominates over that term. Well, in that case, you know, it's going to be an accelerated expansion. Not just an expansion forever, but actually accelerated. Because if this term dominates, the second derivative is positive. So the A dot actually grows. And you can imagine that there is a critical situation that could happen, which is, imagine the universe starts off very fast, and it has lots of matter in it. So the universe starts off expanding very fast, and it has a tremendous deceleration, right? But it's so fast that it goes for a while, and then it dilutes, right? The matter dilutes because of the expansion, which means that the energy density drops, the pressure drops. Still, this term does its best to decelerate the universe, but it's getting weaker and weaker at its job. Because as the universe is expanding, these numbers drop. Until, perhaps, this guy starts dominating. And if it does dominate, well, then you can forget about that one. Because now the universe is going to accelerate. And that means that they start dropping even faster, and there's no way that the universe would ever recollapse. Instead, it's going to go into an accelerated expansion. Now, that may sound weird, but the evidence is that this is what happened. That we are in a universe in which that transition has happened. In which initially the universe had matter content that dominated and decelerated it. But then the matter diluted so much that now and for the past few billion years, the cosmological constant has been dominant. And now we are accelerating. Weird, but that's the evidence. Okay. So the experimental evidence is that supernova distance versus brightness data and evidence from the cosmic microwave background radiation indicate that A double dot is actually larger than zero now. The cosmological constant has already won. At present, the energy density in matter is already sufficiently diluted such that lambda dominates over the energy density. In fact, the evidence shows that about 70% of the zero-zero component of the energy-momentum tensor is cosmologically constant. And only 30% is regular matter. I mean, by regular matter, I'm counting matter, radiation, and dark matter. All of that together is only 30%. And only a tiny fraction of the matter is actually visible matter. So this means that in the far future, the energy density and the pressure will have diluted, or will dilute even more towards zero, leaving only lambda. Because of the tremendous dilution. For example, there should be a time, as it looks now, there should be a time in many billion years when we can't even see neighboring galaxies. Because everything will have expanded away so far. Which will be a weird thing. People then, if there are people, will just have some record of, yeah, there were other galaxies, but we don't see them anymore. They will have retreated so far. Yes, but the main point is that the cosmological constant is going to dominate. And what is that going to do? Well, we can solve the equations for the cosmological constant when it dominates. Because then the Friedmann equation becomes this one. See, this is the left-hand side of the Friedmann equation. Remember, the Friedmann equation was the zero-zero component of the Einstein equation. So what we have is that the zero-zero component of the Einstein equation on the left-hand side is this. On the right-hand side is just a cosmological constant because we dropped the business with the energy density. Now, let's see what that means. You see, we can multiply that equation with A squared. Okay? If we multiply that equation with A squared, forget about the term with k for the moment. Let's just say k equals zero. So the universe is spatially flat. Then we simply have a dot squared is equal to lambda times a squared. Which is to say that a dot is proportional to a. Now what kind of solution do we expect then? When a dot is proportional to a? Exponential. Exactly. So the growth is going to be exponential. So if k equal to zero, the growth is exponential, and the exponential coefficient is square root of lambda third. So if the universe is spatially flat, we're going to have an exponential expansion. If it's not spatially flat, is it then completely different? Well, let's see. The solutions are slightly different. You can still solve the differential equations, and you get the hyperbolic cosine in the case of a positive curvature universe. And if the universe is negative curvature, then it's going to be the hyperbolic sine. But if you look at what the hyperbolic cosine and hyperbolic sine are, yeah, exponential, right? The hyperbolic cosine is just the exponential of this plus the exponential of minus this. The negative part just goes away, the positive part dominates. Both of these, I mean, all the three asymptotically are just exponential. Which means that it doesn't matter what the overall topology of the universe is spatially, whether it is flat or positive curvature or negative curvature, it's going to explode exponentially. So therefore, the current evidence predicts that the expansion of the universe will become more and more like exponential expansion. And since we have some idea of how big the cosmological constant is, we can predict what the rate is going to be and when we go into the exponential phase and so on. However, it has to be said that we should not trust this. And the reason is that we don't understand almost anything in here, right? We see visible matter, but that's just about 3% of all of the contribution to the energy momentum test. It's the only part we understand. Stars and planets, and we don't even see the planets, most of them. It's just 3% of what there is in the energy momentum tensor. And the remaining 97% or so are cosmological constant and dark matter. We don't know what they're going to do in a few billion years. We don't even know. I mean, there's no way. We don't understand these things well enough. It's, I think, too risky to predict that this is what's going to happen. Once we understand what dark matter is, maybe we can make a prediction. But at the moment, we don't know. But we can take note of the fact that this is what we would predict at the moment on the basis of the present knowledge. Okay. Now, remember, these were just some quick conclusions we were able to draw on a very general basis, just looking at the 0-0 and II components of the Einstein equation. Now, let's get to the main business here, which is we have 3 degrees of freedom, namely the scale factor, the energy density, and the pressure. All 3 are functions of time. We need 3 equations for them, but we have only 2. We have the 2 Einstein equations, the 0-0 component, the II component. What can we use for the 3rd? Okay, so here we have 3 unknown functions of time, A of t, rho of t, P of t. And we should have 3 equations that they obey. Namely, the equations A and B, which are the 2 equations of motion, the Einstein equation, the 0-0 component, the II component, and also something that I mentioned, and now we will write it down, namely the relationship between pressure and energy. Remember, I said that this we cannot conclude from gravity alone, what the relationship is between pressure and energy. So, for example, you can have a pressureless gas, which is like a gas of dust. It has a certain energy density because there are the dust grains in there, and they have matter, and therefore they have energy. But if there's a pressureless gas, where the particles don't see each other, and they just pass by each other, then, yeah, you know, the pressure will be just vanishing, even though there's an energy density. But on the other hand, you could have a box which has mirrored walls, perfect mirrored walls. And then in there, you have photons. You have a photon gas. It will have an energy density. Now, if you make the box smaller, the gas will heat up. There's going to be a relationship between the energy density in that photon gas and the pressure in the photon gas. If, on the other hand, you have a box full of hydrogen, again, you have pressure and you have energy density. And as you change pressure and energy density, you know, there's a certain function that relates the two. And that relationship between energy density and pressure is going to provide us with the 3rd equation for the 3 unknowns, right? 0-0 component, II component of the Einstein equation, plus the relationship between energy density and pressure. In your project, you can play with that 3rd one. You can't really change the Einstein equations, they're probably correct. But the relationship between energy density and pressure could be pretty much anything, because that's chemistry or physical chemistry. Different gases have different relationships. And especially when a gas undergoes a phase transition, it will change its relationship between energy density and pressure. The so-called equation of state changes. So the equation of state is the pressure as a function of the energy density. Super important. It tells us if we increase the pressure, how does the energy density change? Or if we pump energy into it, how does the pressure change? Right? And that's physical chemistry. So what is it, for example, in well-known cases? Let's say we have pure vacuum energy. What's the relationship then between, Yeah, vacuum energy is another word for cosmological constant. We don't really know whether the cosmological constant is vacuum energy, but it's the best candidate. Vacuum energy being the constant energy of quantum fields. You know, the thing that's 122 orders of magnitude too big. Anyway, so what would be the relationship between energy density and pressure for the cosmological constant? Do you remember? Remember that the energy density that it contributes is positive, but the pressure it contributes is negative. It contributes plus lambda to the energy density, but minus lambda to the pressure, which means that the pressure is minus the energy density. So the pressure for the pressure associated with the cosmological constant is minus the energy density related to the cosmological constant, because the energy momentum tensor of the cosmological constant is minus lambda, 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 lambda. Right? So the relationship between pressure and energy density is minus 1. And we say, therefore, that the equation of state parameter is minus 1. The ratio of pressure to energy density, which is called the equation of state parameter, is minus 1. Then, for pure radiation, you have a box with mirrored walls and you have photon gas in there. Then, what is the relationship between the pressure of the photon gas and the energy density of the photon gas? Well, that's not our business. You can calculate, you can see that in textbooks on thermodynamics. Black body radiation, you can read that off from there. It would take us too far to rederive that here now. The pressure is a third of the energy density for electromagnetic radiation. Just take it from classical electrodynamics. Right? So if you have a box of photons, then the pressure is a third of the energy density. If, on the other hand, you have a box of just dust, like the universe filled with dust grains, each dust grain is a galaxy, then in this case, the pressure is just zero, right? Because these galaxies don't collide. I mean, essentially not. Okay. Okay, now, a useful observation for our business of solving these equations is this. The Friedmann equation, remember, that's the 0,0 component of the Einstein equation, only contains the scale factor and the energy density, not the pressure. That's in the II component Einstein equation, right? It only contains the scale factor and the energy density. Now, what can we do with this? Well, the idea now is that we try to express the energy density as a function of the scale factor, so that we then obtain the energy density as a function, well, yeah, we obtain the energy density as a function of the scale factor. Then, if we can express the energy density as a function of the scale factor, then the Friedmann equation becomes an ordinary differential equation only for the scale factor. And then we are almost done, because then, once we have the scale factor, we can calculate the other thing. And indeed, there is a very important equation that helps us to find rho of A, helps us to find the energy density as a function of the scale factor. And here's that equation. It can be derived from the two Einstein equations, from the 0,0 component, the Friedmann equation, and the II component together. Obviously, we need both, because one contains only the energy density and the other one contains only the pressure. So the Einstein equations lead to this equation here. Now, in the slides further down, I give you a complete, exact proof of this equation on the basis of GR. But in interest of time, I will not go through the details of it, but I will give you a derivation that's intuitive and quick, that gives you some insight into what that means, because it's basically a continuity equation. Okay, so this equation is going to be very useful because it relates, it will help us solve the Einstein equations by eliminating variables. Okay, so what do we have? Maybe let's look at this equation a little bit. Later I will give you an intuitive proof and then a technical proof, but before we use it, let's look at what we have. This is the energy density times the scale factor to the third power. Scale factor to the third power, that looks like a volume, right? So this is like a volume times an energy density. So this is like an energy, right? So this is like an energy, and this is how the energy changes in a certain volume as we expand the universe, or as the universe expands. And then that is related to the pressure. So generally, if you have a box and you make it bigger or smaller, you work with or against the pressure, then you're pumping energy into it or taking it out. So this is going to be a continuity equation of that kind that relates pressure to energy. You do work against pressure, you put energy in there, and vice versa. That's what it's going to be. But what is the utility of it? For the moment, let's take it for granted. Let's worry about the proof of it later. Let's assume this is granted. Then what can we do with it? We have the Einstein equations, Friedmann equation for the 0-0 component, and the II component. We have this. And we have the equation of state parameter. Right? So I should take a moment and explain that clearly. I said we are going to assume a relationship between the energy density and the pressure. This is something that gravity cannot tell us. This comes from chemistry or physical chemistry, the relationship between pressure and energy density. And as the universe underwent changes, as it went from, you know, highly dense to highly diluted, it underwent phase transitions. There was a period when it was dominated by hot matter. There was a period when it was dominated by hot radiation. That there's a period when it was dominated by a cosmological constant like thing. And now it's starting to be dominated by a cosmological constant again. Which means that the equation of state parameter changed over time. Very early in the universe, as we will see, during the period of inflation, the equation of state parameter was as if there was a large cosmological constant. Remember what that means? It means the equation of state parameter is about minus one. Right? Cosmological constant means that the energy density is minus the pressure. That's because the cosmological constant contributes to the energy momentum tensor as cosmological constant times the metric. And the metric has sign signature minus 1111, right? So the cosmological constant contributes positively in the 0-0 components, but negatively in the II components. Okay, so what we have to do is, in order to solve for the history of the universe, is that we have to divide the history of the universe into epochs. An epoch being defined as a period in which the relationship between energy density and pressure was a particular one. And then when it changed for some reason, for example, because the universe underwent a phase transition, then we got a different equation of state. And then maybe it underwent another phase transition or something else happened, different equation of state. In practice, it means, for example, this. The universe might have started out as a very hot, dense plasma, matter-dominated. And then we have to ask, okay, what's the relationship between energy density and pressure for matter? That's the relationship we have to put into the equations here to get the evolution of the universe. But then later, at some point, the universe might have been dominated by radiation. Or maybe it was first radiation dominated and then matter dominated. We will find out next lecture. But as it went from one period to the other, for example now, or a few billion years ago, matter got so diluted that the cosmological constant started to dominate. That means that the equation of state changed, the relationship between energy density and pressure changed. So in each epoch, we have to solve the dynamics separately. So now, let's do this for particular epochs. For particular situations in which the equation of state is a particular one. So, for example, let's say the pressure is W times rho during a certain time period in the history of the universe, and the W, the so-called equation of state parameter, takes a particular value. So, for example, for the case where we have a universe that's filled with dust grains being, for example, galaxies, we have that the pressure is zero. We have energy density, but no pressure. In this case, P is zero times rho. So we have that W is zero. Okay, now in that case, what do we have? Let's look at the equation here. Right, so if P is equal to zero, P is equal to zero, the right-hand side is equal to zero, and from that, we have that d by dA of this is equal to zero, but that means that the rho has to go like a to the power minus 3. Right? If rho goes like a to the power minus 3, then this is a constant, which it should be because d by dA is zero. So in the case of dust, rho is a to the power minus 3. In the case of radiation, where the universe is just filled with a gas of photons, then the relationship between pressure and energy density is a third. The pressure is one third of the energy density. So we have to write here, for P, we can write rho divided by 3. Now if we want to solve the differential equation, the solution is rho is a to the power minus 4. Or let us look at the case of pure cosmological constant. In this case, as we said, P is minus rho. Then we can plug here minus rho. If we solve the differential equation now, we find that the energy density has to be constant. Now, why is that plausible, what we get here? You see, what we find here is that if the universe is filled with dust, the energy density dilutes like a to the power minus 3. Which means the volume grows like a to the power 3. The matter density, therefore, dilutes like a to the power minus 3. On the other hand, if the universe is filled with radiation, then as the volume grows like a to the power 3, the volume of any fixed box grows like a to the power 3, the energy density actually drops like a to the power minus 4. Why would that be? Any idea? Yes, but why would the energy density dilute like a to the power minus 4, not a to the power minus 3? See, the volume grows like a to the power 3. But the energy density, unlike for matter, for radiation, the energy density depletes like a to the power minus 4.
Wavelengths.
Yes, exactly. It's because, exactly, the photons get diluted, but on top of that, they also get redshifted. And they lose energy through that. Which is very important because it means that during expansion, the radiation loses energy density faster than matter does. And of course, the cosmological constant has an energy density that's constant. If the universe is filled with cosmological constant energy, well, as the universe expands, that energy doesn't get diluted. Remember that in general relativity, there's no energy conservation. Right? Unless you have Killing vector fields, etc., etc. But what we see here is that the universe can expand and create any amount of energy. There's no lack of energy. Okay, so now what's the intuitive meaning of the key equation that we use to deduce all of these things? This equation here, which is a so-called continuity equation. What's the intuitive meaning of this thing? So it's basically a general relativity version of the continuity equation for adiabatic expansion. What's adiabatic expansion? It's an expansion of a box such a way that there's no heat exchange with the environment. In this case, we have classically, for ordinary gases, we have that the change in energy is given by minus P, the change in the volume, which is really just Newton's law, that if you do work against the force, if you work against the force, then you put energy in there. And the pressure times dV is really just the force. Force times distance, right? Force times distance is energy, is work, that's what it expresses here. And if you, in this case here, say that the V, the volume, is a to the power 3, scale factor. And if you say that the energy is volume times energy density, if that's what you put in here, so energy is energy density times volume, then this equation here that we understand well, but is classical, becomes d of a to the third rho equal to minus p d of a to the third, which is this. And now if you divide that equation by dA, you get d by dA of that equal to this, which is the equation that we've been using. So it's really just a continuity equation. We know that it has to hold true in the simple case, simple non-relativistic case, but it does actually carry forward to the relativistic case, and that's very useful. Okay, and the rest of the notes are just a proof of that equation. And you see, it's quite non-trivial, but we are out of time, and it's a good exercise for you to go through these things and figure it out. Okay. Right? Any questions?
How do we know that there's only dust, radiation, and cosmological constant?
We don't. There may be other things. In particular, we don't really know what the dark matter does. There's a huge debate of what dark matter is. And at the moment, the evidence is consistent with dark matter consisting of tables and chairs. It seriously is. It could be just that. It's just flying around, but invisible. I mean, there's even the exciting possibility that dark matter may be a regular kind of matter, the kind of matter that we see around us, but in an extended standard model of particle physics. You see, in particle physics, we have three families of particles. Like we have the electron, and then we have a mu brother of the electron, and a tau sister of the electron, and they are just like the electron in every regard, just a little heavier. And then the same is true for neutrinos. We have three generations of neutrinos and all the quarks as well. So there's a whole zoo of particles, and they see different interactions, the strong and the weak interaction and so on, with various different couplings. And we don't really understand the origin of the standard model of particle physics. But this is what describes all the matter that we see around us, including the stars as far as we can see. We can look at the physics and the chemistry far out in the universe. It all matches what we see with our standard model. But it could be that the standard model is very incomplete. It could be that there are other generations of particles, including stable particles, which have one little flaw, which is they don't have an interaction Hamiltonian with the other part of the standard model that we are made of. Right? It could seem, just like, for example, electrons don't feel the strong force. They're completely impervious to it. They don't know about the existence of the strong force. Electrons only feel gravity, the weak force, and the electromagnetic force. But they have no idea of the strong force, completely oblivious to it. And so similarly, neutrinos have no idea of the existence of electromagnetism. Right? They just don't see it. They're neutral. And so it could be that there are particle species which are neutral with respect to electromagnetism, the weak interaction, the strong interaction, which means they don't interact with the matter that we see. But every particle will have an energy momentum tensor and will therefore impact gravity. And we do know that there is a lot of energy momentum tensor out there whose origin we don't know. For example, in our galaxy, there is way more matter than what we can see. And it could well be that this is matter made out of, you know, atoms, perhaps planets, perhaps stars, this matter organizes itself differently, but it would be matter that simply doesn't interact with through the weak, the strong, or the electromagnetic interaction, which means we don't see it. It just goes right through us. And the only way that it has to interact with us is gravitationally. And that's actually the only way we know of its existence, because it makes our galaxy way heavier. It means, for example, that stars that are far out in our galaxy should orbit the center of our galaxy with a certain rotational frequency based on how much mass we see in the galaxy. But it actually, these faraway stars rotate around our galaxy way faster than it's explained this way. There has to be much more mass in our galaxy to bind these stars so tightly that they go so fast around. And that's true for virtually every galaxy, for all galaxies that we've looked at. So one possibility is that the dark matter is matter that is quite different from the matter that we see. It could even be an exact copy of the standard model that we have, except those guys don't interact with ours. They may have their own weak interaction, their own strong interaction, but don't interact with us. Or they could be completely different. And they could have all kinds of equations of state. Right? For them, the dark for the dark matter, the W could be the one or the other thing. It could change. You know, dark matter could undergo phase transitions that we would never anticipate because we don't know what it does. We only see the gravitational impact of the dark matter. Yeah, so we don't know. Dark matter is a big unknown. By far, most of the contributions to the energy momentum tensor are dark energy, which is to say a cosmological constant. I should say cosmological constant, dark energy, and vacuum energy are used synonymously, almost synonymously. And then dark matter is different. Dark matter is matter. It actually contributes to the energy momentum tensor in a dynamic way. Whereas a cosmological constant, vacuum energy, or dark energy is a constant. It's literally constant. You fix it once and for all, right? That's the lambda. Yeah, and since we don't know this stuff, we can't really predict the future. But we seem to have the tools, right? We just don't know what the ingredients are. So we have a kitchen, but we don't know what the ingredients are. Right. I think this is one of the major challenges of our time. It's not like we have a lack of evidence, really. I mean, sometimes people complain and they say, oh, it's so expensive to do experiments nowadays. We have to send satellites into space and we have to build these huge, expensive accelerators. But look, there's a lot of unexplained evidence, like the structure of the standard model of particle physics. We don't understand at all what it is. Another huge chunk of evidence is that there is dark matter. We can map it out gravitationally and we don't know what it is. And then there's dark energy and it dominates everything and we don't know why it takes the value it does. It ought to be 122 orders of magnitude larger from what we know. So all of those things are huge questions that somebody clever ought to solve. You know, when Einstein came up with general relativity, there was no pressure to do it. The only little piece of evidence he had was that the Mercury shift of perihelion, the perihelion shift of Mercury, sorry. What? Not commutative, is it? that the perihelion shift of Mercury was not accurately predicted by Newton, even taking into account higher order perturbation theory. And then he came up with this huge theory. And now we have way more evidence than just the perihelion shift of Mercury. Maybe one of you figures it out. Okay, any further questions? Okay. So I'll see you on Friday then.